3. It's March 28th, 2003. I'm Fred Honhart, and I'm here with Marvin Zalman. And Marvin, as you can see, we're going to tape record this. Do you have your permission to do so?
Yes.
Thank you. What I'd like to talk to you about is our mutual friend, Ralph Turner. But before we start that, I'd like a little background about your upbringing and education. So where were you born, and where did you go to school?
I'm from New York City. I went to Cornell University. After I graduated from Cornell in 1963, I went to Brooklyn Law School. Graduated in 1966, and in 1966 I graduated, took the bar exam, passed it, got married. My wife and I, Greta, had taken tests earlier for the Peace Corps, and later that year we found ourselves in Nigeria. In the Peace Corps, teaching law, while I was there, actually towards the end of my term, I was just willy-nilly assigned to teach criminal law and criminal procedure, and I started, because I was bored, there wasn't a lot to do in northern Nigeria, started researching what I was teaching in a variety of ways, and at the sometime before coming home, Greta noticed an ad for a something I'd never heard of, a School of Criminal Justice at State University of New York at Albany. So we figured that having had a child born there, maybe we'd have an easy year back in the States in Albany rather than the rigors of law practice in New York. And I entered the School of Criminal Justice at Albany in 69. In 1971, I had a master's on the way to getting a PhD. And we were looking to move on, so I took a job at MSU. That's how I got into criminal justice, to make it short. And
how did you come to MSU? What was the background of getting here?
Well, I just applied for several positions, and the one that seemed most attractive was at MSU. I interviewed here in the spring of 71. And we decided to come out.
Do you remember any of the people who you interviewed with?
I was interviewed by Ralph because Art Brandstetter was on sabbatical. So he was the man who was in charge of the department as acting chair. And I remember when I came up for the interview, actually Greta and I had... I guess the semester was either over or it was during a break. It might have been during a spring break. We had a daughter, Amy, and I believe we visited her parents in Miami. So we were spending a week in Miami, and that's when I got the call from MSU. I flew up to East Lansing. I remember going from Miami. It was freezing up here. It was springtime. Now, it must have been during a spring break, so let's say it's March or April. I couldn't believe how cold it was. And I remember coming back and telling Greta, I was interviewed by a guy who chain smoked cigars.
right.
First memory of Ralph. It went well, and we came out, I guess, in July. I also have a very strong memory of Ralph because, we were just grad students, essentially. We packed up our belongings in a U-Haul with a car latched on in the back, and while looking for an apartment, Ralph and Arnella, as we had mentioned at lunch, I think had gone on a short trip to Taiwan, I believe, and they very generously put their house at our disposal. So for our first, 2-3 weeks, maybe it was a month, in East Lansing, Greta and I lived at the Turner's residence. It was a wonderful, wonderful house, and it was a very special treat. And we found an apartment on Okemos Road, and then a couple of years later, purchased the house.
Like you, at lunch, you told us the story. Tell us again what you said about Ralph.
I won't do my dialect of Ralph's accent, but Ralph was showing us around the house as a New York City kid. Living in a house was something kind of amazing. I lived in apartments all my life. And the house, of course, was built on the Frank Lloyd Wright model, as I learned more about that later. But he was very proud. of the brick that he had from the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, the first Imperial Hotel, I guess, or maybe the only one. I'm not an architecture buff. And he had it in sort of like a little shrine tucked away it's sort of a niche fireplace. It was very attractive, or at least a niche, an architectural niche, in the a living room or a den. And he said, Zalman says, if a fire breaks out and this house starts burning down, the first thing you do is you get this brick out, and when it's secure, you can go back and get your kid and your wife. So. He clearly made it, you know, he made it pretty plain that that was a pretty valuable object to him.
How did you interact with him your first year here? You said he was gone for a while.
No. That was only for the summer.
For the summer, right.
So that, I was at MSU from 71 to 1980, and at the end of the winter or spring semester in 1980, I went to MSU, we were quite friendly, and I was quite close to Ralph throughout that period. You probably recall the dinner where I sort of made that joke about him being my rabbi.
Yes.
At MSU, and I gave him that yarmulke, and everybody cracked up. I was always sort of fascinated by what he did. I can remember when we were still at Olds Hall. I don't remember when we moved to the present quarters of the school, which is in, I'm forgetting, a modern building that it's in, Baker,
right.
Baker Hall. We were on the top floor of Olds Hall, and I had a room all the way at the end, which is, I guess, where Ray LeGrand was. He had suddenly left. I'm trying to remember. I might have replaced. I was the replacement for Frank Day, who was. If you ever want to get into the history of the school, he was quite a character, very nice man. I'm trying to think whether I was immediately put into this very large office at the end of the hall. Or whether that happened shortly thereafter, because within a short period of time, Ray LeGrand, who was the other attorney on staff, left to take a job as, I think, chief of police in Miami Beach, Florida, and that's when Zoltan was hired, either immediately or within a year. So I was down at the end of the hall with Ralph, and I remember sitting there one day reading, and I heard a gun go off, and I got up and walked around, and he was on a platform firing a pistol or a revolver into a long metal tank with batting materials that would capture the bullet for inspection. And I thought it was rather odd. Most departments, you didn't usually hear guns popping off. But he explained some of the basics of a bullet analysis to me, and some of the basic terms, cantilevers and lands and grooves, and told me a little bit about his work. I thought it was just fascinating. Having lived there, we were friendly with Ralph and Arnell, and he was very hospitable to all faculty and to junior faculty, and he'd often have people over for drinks and helped to create a social atmosphere. Of course, there was also a very big difference in age, so it wasn't exactly within the age group that we were hanging around with, people with young kids and the like.
Do you remember anything in particular about Ralph as far as a teacher?
Well, my recollection is that he taught only the criminalistics classes and not outside there. And so he had a lot of graduate students and very specialized students, very popular. They really loved him. He was very good with the foreign students. I had mentioned Singh and who's at Grambling now, I'm blocking his name, man at the, in fact, he's made quite a name for himself, publishing about police, Indian. You'll have to forgive me, I sometimes blank out on names of people I really know well, so that does happen. He was very modest about his own attainments, and over the years things came out about him that were really amazing and astounding, and he wasn't the sort of person who would sort of open up, and I mean he was very friendly, very cordial, and a great raconteur. But not so forthcoming with things about himself. But over the years I learned about his love of architecture, for example, how he was a student of and correspondent with Frank Lloyd Wright. I think at one point when we were there, maybe it was upon his retirement, he wanted to spend a year in Taliesin West. I don't think he did that. But I discovered, for example, that he had, with his own hands, done a lot of the construction on his own house, I remember when I bought my first house, and I was a little nervous about that, he talked about his own feelings of nervousness when they bought the property on the
Hewlett Road,
right by the tracks, and they had a guy come out with a backhoe, and they dug out they dug out the place where the foundation was going to go. And he said, I stood there looking at this hole in the ground and was wondering what was going to happen. But it's just an amazing house. Maybe it's more Frank Lloyd Wright than the Frank Lloyd Wright that's two or three houses down. That alone was an amazing accomplishment, and it showed a lot of the depth and talent he had. He was an excellent photographer, he had a lot of his pictures up, and clearly did very good work along those lines. He certainly, from all of his travels, had a wonderful knowledge of the world, gleaned by personal experience. I never thought of it exactly this way. He reminded me a little bit of my father, who was not a professor, a professional. I believe he was an accountant in the old country. In terms of being an essentially cheerful person, very upbeat personality, a bit unassuming, but very sharp in terms of sort of understanding, the way of the world, and I think he was very good on reading people. Not at all interested in university politics, departmental politics. There were a few, probably less than most other places when I was there in the 70s, but a certain amount of politics. And Ralph was, I think, more interested in his own work. And teaching and scholarship, but he knew, who was who and what people were about. And I always very much treasured his friendship. I don't know, funny stories. Sometimes, since I lived not far from him for the first two or three years, in the apartments on Okemos Road. I don't know if I had car problems, he would pick me up. But I know that once we went, he picked me up, we went to campus together. It wasn't common, but it was on election day. And I remember we both went to vote. And there was an elderly gentleman who was there who was one of the original residents out in at the MSU properties when it was taken over by, around the area where Hannah lived. And Ralph seemed to know all about the history of the road is named after.
Del Bennett?
No, it's...
Okay.
But but it was sort of a crotchety old guy who had a life estate. I sold his property to MSU and then was allowed to live on the house for the rest of his life, and was reputed to occasionally shoot off a shotgun at MSU students who would come around and harass him. I don't know exactly how true that was, but he certainly had a good knowledge of the sort of local lore. Of course, I came to MSU at the tail end of Ralph's illustrious career. He retired towards the end. I forget the exact year, but Jay Siegel had come on board. And I know the whole field of criminal justice was changing. In the 40s, when MSU developed into its, I mean, I know the school goes back to the 30s, but in some ways, the program was really created after World War II.
Correct.
Brandstetter, Turner, another man who I really loved very much, Bob Scott, before he went back to corrections and then came back. Back in those days, the few schools of police administration made criminalistics a core part of the program. I think that was true, and certainly in the Berkeley program. And I guess I'm not sure how far back the Chicago Circle, the University of Illinois at Chicago goes, but they had a criminalistics program. And I think in the 70s, by the 70s, the criminal justice revolution had started, and there were question marks about whether or not the criminalistics program should be kept. I was a junior professor, an assistant professor. I was busy working on my dissertation. I don't think I got involved in that too much, but it certainly was an issue. And I can't say that I'm privy to exactly how that all worked out. I think Vic Strecker may have had a lot to do with ensuring that the program would continue. Issues of funding, it's a major expense, and whether or not it should be an integral part of the CJ program or quasi-independent. I gather now it has some... I'm not sure exactly how it's connected to the School of Criminal Justice, but I know it has a lot of independence, as it probably should.
I've just recently instituted a master's program, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. having tremendous success in terms of applicants and numbers.
Right. So I don't know if that was much of a concern of Ralph's. We didn't talk about that a lot. I know there was this... once he said that he didn't exactly say I'm slowing down. He said something to the effect, maybe it would be around 74 thereabouts, that 20 years before he could have done a lot more in the lab. So I think there was a sense that there was a need to bring somebody else in who was younger. At the same time, at least one. Event that took place in the early 70s indicated his stature in the field. He was one of several, and Vic, I think, could tell you more about this, one of several criminalists who did analysis of the bullets in a civil case coming out of the Robert Kennedy assassination. And the fact that he was selected as one around the nation to participate in a traditionally established experiment, I think spoke very well to his credibility. But I'd say that by the time I met him, I think probably his great work was done. And he would talk about the development of the breathalyzer and those, Shenley, was it? Seagram? I think it was whoever gave him the tank car of whiskey.
Probably was Seagram.
Seagram. It sort of made me wish that I was at MSU in the 40s. Go to a free party and get a little drunk for science.
For research and science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd say that my own background was in law. The new field of criminal justice that was just developing. I was in the second class at SUNY Albany, had very much a social science approach to analyzing the phenomenon of criminal justice agencies, behaviors, criminology, and the like. And I didn't think very much about criminalistics. Knew very little about it when I came out to MSU. And the associations with Ralph sort of made me appreciate, as an outsider, the value of the field. I can't say that I thought it was absolutely essential. I mean, one of the things I would go around saying in the 70s was that most cases are solved not by scientific crime detection, but by interrogation and ordinary police work. But from what I said at lunch about my interest in wrongful convictions, it really is an absolutely essential field, and probably becoming more important now, I think, as tools of detection become more refined, as departments become more professional and are better able to collect information. Crime scene analysts are more routine and more standardized. The work is becoming very important, and certainly in law as well. So I think criminalistics has a tremendous role to play, not only in the obvious job of catching or at least confirming the guilt of the suspects, but to exonerate people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important.
Did Ralph ever talk to you about his stuttering problem as a child?
Yeah, yeah. After a few years, I mean, not the sort of thing he would mention. You know, he had this sort of long, slow drawl, sort of an amusing way of talking, and you know, it seemed like an interesting speech characteristic that everybody noticed, and it's kind of easy to you know, mimic. But yeah, at some point, I think probably, if I recall, it was at his house. He mentioned that he had a very severe stuttering problem. He indicated that he went to a psychoanalyst, and I guess there were, you know, many different theories and schools of thought about stuttering over the years. With some bemusement, his analyst was in correspondence with Freud. I guess this was in the 30s.
Smiley Blanton was the guy's name, and he was in New York City.
Huh. I didn't know who it was, so
yeah.
He didn't dwell on it at great length, but he did indicate that he had overcome the problem. And then that made me appreciate a little bit more that sort of deliberateness of his speech. You know, an interesting part of him. I remember once, I was in Olds Hall, and you know, Ralph would come in sometimes. He loved to work on his own property, and had a riding tractor and had peach trees. I mean, we discovered that when we were first here, which surprised me. I mean, I didn't think of peach trees in a northern climate. You know, if I worked out in the yard, I'd just wear a pair of dungarees. And Ralph wore this sort of like a custodian's outfit.
You know, brown.
Green or brown, matching jacket and pants. So you know, he looked like somebody was hired to clean up your property. And I think he was dressed that way once on a Saturday on campus. We might have run into Walter Adams, who was kind of joking with him as if Ralph was a rube. And you know, I liked Walter, but I think it was Walter. It could have been somebody else, but
sounds like Walter.
But I you know, I got this impression that people didn't, you know, they really did think of Ralph as something of a hayseed, and just either they were joking, or they really didn't know how accomplished he really was. So, and you know, he'd laugh it off. It didn't bother him at all.
I suspect in Walter's case he knew, since they were in Cherry Lane together when they first came here.
Well, maybe.
But Walter also had his own ego problems. So.
Well, there certainly were a lot of characters at MSU. Lash LaRue.
Right.
Adams was polished, but he was a bit of a character.
Very much a character.
Bob Scott was not a person who was a character as such, but a very deep and unusual man.
Could you talk a little bit about Bob?
Scott. Well, I have very fond memories of Bob. I only got to meet him after he retired from the Department of Corrections. He was rehired by Brandstetter, I believe it was by Brandstetter, to teach a few classes in corrections on a part-time basis. And Bob, the shock of white hair, and what I got to know was, first of all, as we well remember, since we used to lunch together, he was this wonderful punster.
Oh, yes.
And he would tell puns, and he would get us all going. And once you hear some puns, you start chiming in, so he would have us all punning. There is something about Bob that actually does relate to Ralph, but let me get to that. And, I learned that Bob was a lawyer. He was a magistrate in upstate New York, met Brandstetter during World War II, became intrigued by this idea of the School of Police Science and Art, talked him into coming out to MSU, or maybe it was still MSC then, right after the war, and he participated in the department, a very humanistic man who believed very much in rehabilitation and helping juveniles, and went to work for the Department of Corrections for many years. And I had quite a few connections with the corrections in the late 70s because I took a sabbatical, went to work for the Supreme Court to develop sentencing guidelines, and that involved me a lot with the corrections people. They referred to Scott as the conscience of the Department of Corrections. Here's the connection. Bob never mentioned his religion. I think he had he was Episcopal, very devout Episcopal, but he never, he never mentioned it. It was a very deep part of him, and it's not something he preached or talked about. It was just something about, he lived it. I think that was true with Ralph as well. I only learned at his funeral that he was deeply involved with his church. And, I sort of refer to them as Christian gentlemen. It never came up in conversation,
right.
but very, very decent people. Very helping, always supportive of others. Friendly and very open-minded, certainly in terms of Ralph was a world traveler and just sort of very easygoing about taking people as they come. We had a lot of foreign students at MSU, and I think Ralph played a role with a lot of them. He sort of had no problems with cultural differences, and he may have had, I think he played a social role in the department. A certain amount of social leadership is important. Brandstetter's would have a party once a year, which is, I guess appropriate for a director. But Ralph would, he would have impromptu parties for junior faculty, and I think he tried to get people together to talk to one another. Early on, when I first came on, there were some junior faculty. There was a Bill Hegarty, who later became police chief in Grand Rapids, I believe. He was there for a couple of years and then moved on. And there was an African-American guy, for the life of me, I can't remember his name, who taught for a couple of years and then I think became the police chief of the Virgin Islands, or a town in the Virgin Islands, who was in federal service. And I remember Ralph would have us over sometimes, and you're the future of MSU, and I think it was a very nice gesture. Trying to think whether at those lunchtime, you might remember this better. Who was a regular? Ralph was a regular.
Ralph.
Lou Radlett.
Lou Radlett. Bob Scott.
Bob Scott. You and I used to attend quite frequently, and From, well, there was Malman, the chemist.
Walter Malman.
Paris? The guy who worked in the library.
Yeah, Paris.
He worked in the library or administration?
Right, no, he worked in the library.
And Mladen.
And Mladen Kaplan.
Mm-hmm.
And who was the guy in financial aid?
The heavyset guy,
yeah.
Dykema?
Yeah, Henry Dykema.
You see, you start pumping me and I'll remember. Oh, the Indian student whose name I couldn't remember before was Dilip Das, D-A-S. He's at Plattsburgh now, and I think both he and Singh, I mean, I think I would recommend that you chat with them as foreign students, you know, who felt
right.
very welcomed by Ralph. He'd go out of his way to sort of bring them in.
Yes, that was sort of his hallmark as well. Let's stop here for just a second.